of Black Nationalism. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Doesn't this line ever move?
Someone can't decide which donut.
I just want my 7-grain bread, that's all.
The apple pie is on sale.
The apple pie is from yesterday.
I feel like I'm from yesterday.
What is so hard about picking a donut?
Well, some people don't make snap decisions.
Flip a coin.
Or take your time. I don't mind waiting my turn.
But this isn't just waiting.
It's waiting and waiting and waiting.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org.
WBAI is the radio station speaking truth to power, presenting a range of alternative views so you can keep your sanity, like Elvis Costello says as he walks through troubled times. What's so funny about this love and understanding? And for WBAI to continue, we must pay rent at 4 Times Square, which houses WBAI's transmitter.
So a really good reason to support WBAI right now. Help the one truly listener-sponsored radio station pay for the rent to house our transmitter.
What are you going to do when it's gone? Then right. You're going to have to listen to pancake recipes by Brian Lehrer. Yeah.
$17,000 a month is what it costs, and we are trying to raise enough funds for 2022. Please go to towerfund.wbai.org, towerfund.wbai.org, and donate to keep listener-sponsored WBAI broadcasting into the future, or call 212-209-2950 and say you want to donate to WBAI's Tower Fund. Thank you.
Program is brought to you on recording. You are tuned, in case they haven't told you enough yet, to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City. WBAI broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program mostly dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, we will have an interview and a reading from Randy Dodd, media journalist, science fiction writer. Well, lots of good stuff. Stay tuned. Once again, good morning. Well, I wish that I could start the show off with sparkly, happy news, but I'm afraid there's been some sad news. We've lost another person. I have heard tell that you get to a certain age, and I just had another birthday, so I'm getting toward that age, where it used to be that people used to just read the obituaries, just, you know, take a look in the newspaper, see who died today. And, you know, it's not necessarily a pandemic thing, although that doesn't help. I don't know how many times over that I am at risk. I'm over 65. God help me. I'm diabetic type 2. Okay, that's not too bad. And, oh, I've had asthma and stuff like that there. But that's not the issue. Sometimes it's just old age. It's the people that you grew up admiring, respecting, people older than yourself. And I have always felt myself to be younger than what is my true age. I'm, you know, the Jack Benny type. I'm 39 years old. And all the people around me at WBAI, many of whom, in fact, I'm older than they are, but I think of them as being older than me. That may also have something to do with the fact that I started working here at age 13. So, in other words, the people that are passing sometimes are passing simply because they're 20 years or so older than me. Well, one of my favorite writers, a person who I didn't know exceedingly well, but I knew well enough that if you go to his Wikipedia page, it turns out, I'm just looking at it now, that I took the photo of him that they use. And this is Ron Goulart. And Ron died a day after his 89th birthday. Okay, he died January 14th, 2022, born January 13th, 1933. And aside from being amazingly prolific and a lot of fun to read, he generally wrote with a light touch. He wrote a detective series where the detective who figures out who done it and all that was none other than Groucho Marx. He wrote under, I don't know how many pseudonyms. Wikipedia lists a whole lot of them. They list about 12 or 13, and it's not a complete list. One of the pseudonyms that he wrote under, and I didn't necessarily always say this on the air, but it was an open secret that he wrote under the name William Shatner. Unfortunately, Ron did not get to go on a flight into outer space, but, at least not really, but Ron, again, open secret, wrote the Tech War novels, T-E-K-W-A-R, which Shatner was well known for. And the way the story goes is that Shatner wrote outlines and consulted with Ron a great deal. And Ron wrote the books. One time I tripped him up. I brought a bunch of his books, including any number of his mystery novels and science fiction and fantasy novels, most of which are humorous, to autograph. And he'd look at each one and say, "Ah, yes, I remember writing this." And I handed him a Tech War book. And he said, "Oh, this was a fun one to write." And he autographed it for me. And I said, "Ah, you're William Shatner." It may have been a somewhat open secret, but it was nonetheless a secret, you know, because you're not supposed to tell people that this famous person did not, in fact, write their own books. That was Ron Goulart, and I'm sure that Shatner was not the only person who Ron wrote for. But he was a fun read. He fell into that category like Douglas Adams or Terry Pratchett and all that. I would say that, well, you know, let's not compare them because you can't. Douglas Adams' greatest work was his writing scripts for radio, like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And again, I love to remind people, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was a radio show long before it was a book. Okay? But Ron had that, pardon me, he had that light touch. And he loved being thoroughly fantastic about what it could be. And you say, "Oh, it's a murder mystery with, well, as I mentioned, Groucho Marx as the detective." Not a character Groucho was playing, but the actor Groucho Marx. And this made Ron's writing a joy to read. He had a good sense of prose. He knew how much fun his stuff was. I had him on the show once. I had him read at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings twice. And if I saw him at a convention or something, we'd generally grab a table in the hallway or something and sit down together and chat. I'd also do that with his wife, Frances, who's a wonderful person. And that's the most important part. He was a wonderful person. He was a fun person. And as a consumer of his mysteries and his speculative fiction, if you saw his name on a book, you generally knew you were going to have a good time. The problem was figuring out what names he used in addition. And by the way, he wrote romance novels under female pseudonyms. So That's secondary. Primary is Goulart, G-O-U-L-A-R-T, was simply a good read. He was a lot of fun to read, a lot of fun to meet, and he had a good life and deserved all the praise he could get, and the world is richer for having had him in it, and a little sadder for his having left it at this point, because he was working pretty much right up to the end. And what more can one say other than I'm going to go through my archives. Now, my archives, a lot of them, the vast majority of them, before a certain date, were destroyed in a flood, something that really, really is extremely upsetting when you bear in mind that I started with Hour of the Wolf solo in 1973. So that's a lot of years of air checks and stuff. And before that, it was Margot Adler, but I never had those air checks. More is the pity, because I would love to be playing some of those on this show. But I want to find the readings that Ron did for either the New York Review of Science Fiction readings or Hour of the Wolf, and present them for you real soon. Okay, this morning, our guest is Randy Dawn. We recorded this interview yesterday. It was my intent to produce this program in advance and upload it, an hour or so before it was to begin. But what Sean Rhodes, our engineer, person who signs on and all that, takes care of making sure that WBAI is functioning and running, pointed out that there can be problems getting to this place by 6 a.m., and he may not be here to press that button to start the show. And I didn't upload it by midnight when Giovanni, who was the engineer until midnight, could have loaded it into this software that we have to pre-play it. So even though this program was recorded, some 14 hours ago, I've still had to come in this delightful hot weather. It's steaming outside. We're having a heat wave. No, wrong song. It's freezing. It's cold outside. Heat wave, it's cold outside, all right? And, well, what can I say beyond that? So here I am with the interview to play. Now I have to find out where I put it on this hard drive. I have still not yet, there it is, become accustomed to Windows 10. I'm going to have to, because my good old Windows 7 machine at home is, well, suffering from memory loss. And it needs replacing. I have it's not a brand new machine. I got it last April. It's been sitting in a corner of what is laughingly called my office, it's actually a dining room, since last April. I have to put it together, get it going, and here I have to use Windows 10, and at home I will soon have to do it. So without any further ado, we will tell you who Randy Dawn is in the course of this recording. But, well, that's it. There's a pitch within the show. There's a station break. We're all set. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Oh, yes, important. It's slightly edited. I had to cut a little bit for time. And if you want to watch the radio show, well, you can, because we recorded it showing it online. So you can watch the archive. You can go to Facebook and go to the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook. And I also have it on YouTube under my name, Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D. So if you like this show so much that you want to hear it again, or better yet, watch it and see the parts that were lifted out, there's about, 8 or 9 minutes of additional material. That's what you do. So in the meantime, as I was saying before, sit back, relax, and enjoy. Good afternoon if you are with us live, and good morning if you are listening to the broadcast over WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio at 99.5 FM, and we are recording on Facebook and YouTube at the same time. And, and we have a couple of viewers, which is always nice.
Yay.
One of them is probably in the room with me, I suspect. First of all, let's introduce you in general.
Okay.
And then let's each promote our reading series that aren't happening in January.
Yeah,
exactly. So, let's put it this way. There could be an Apple Hills. Randy, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself? You've been an entertainment coverer professional.
That's the official title, by the way, coverer.
Yes.
I come with a duvet.
Yes, exactly.
Put on top of things. I'm an entertainment journalist, which I have been doing since high school, basically, in one form or the other. I used to do a lot of rock journalism.
3 years.
Yes, exactly. Just a bare 3 years ago,
yes.
I was stitching my duvet. I did rock journalism for a bunch of years, and then I shifted into television and film, and that's kind of where I've stayed. I write for outlets including Variety, the LA Times, the Today Show's website, Emmy.com, a lot of different entertainment outlets. But with the Today Show people, I often am doing things that are more lifestyle related. So I end up doing food, or I do home related things. It really kind of whatever they throw at me. Mostly it's entertainment, but amusingly, and please tell me if I'm getting off course here, but I know we have time. Most amusingly, I did a story for the Today Show. You may have read something about this. There was a very small Italian restaurant in Italy that got a Michelin star, and it also got a review from this woman who does a website called, it's not like Eatist, but it's something like that. And she went with a bunch of friends, and they had a 4.5 hour tasting menu dinner of things that were more or less inedible or so pretentious as to be just bizarre. And the most bizarre was the chef had made a plaster cast of his mouth and served a citrus foam in the mouth with no utensils. So the only way to eat this thing was literally to lick it out of the mouth.
Lick this guy's mouth.
Really, that's rated R in a way. So anyway, that went viral. And then I covered it for the Today Show, and nobody had reached out to the restaurant. And so I reached out to the restaurant and I said, hey, we just spoke to the author of this review. Do you want to comment back? Figuring they would say, we stand by our food and we think it's a great idea and we're sorry she didn't enjoy it. Instead, they sent a 3-page response with the requirement that we printed in its entirety. And it came with pictures of horses, did 3 different pictures of horses and a big super pretentious explanation about, anybody can cook a meal. Anybody can ride a horse. But this is us cooking a meal. This is somebody else very, very experienced riding a horse. It was hilarious. Anyway, that went bananas. And so anyway, that's a bit of a tangent, but that is another sort of writing that I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of fun.
I did actually hear about that.
Yeah, that's just it. When I bring it up to some people, I went to Worldcon shortly after it came out, and when I would mention it to people, or somebody mentioned it on my behalf, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, I read about that." So
it went a bit viral, didn't it?
Yeah, it was a you know, 3-day wonder kind of thing. But so that's the official job. But the reason you're having me on today is not necessarily about that. It's because I also write short stories.
Nothing to do with licking anything out of any plaster mouth.
No, exactly. That is not the reason I'm here today. I'm an author. I've always wanted to be an author, and I guess I've been an author if you want to go with the whole sort of, if you write, you're a writer, and I guess I am a writer in that way. But I've had some short stories published, and I am now having a novel published in August called Tune In Tomorrow. It is a humorous pop culture fantasy about a reality TV show run by mythical creatures, but all of the cast are humans. And there's magic, and there's dragons who do security, and there's a love triangle, and there's a murder mystery, or maybe a murder mystery.
I went to that con.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's just part of the whole thing does take place at the show's convention, so which is suspiciously like the Aresia we are not going to this weekend.
Right. Yeah.
So. Anyway, so yeah, that's the book that's coming out. It's coming out on Solaris Rebellion on August 16th, excuse me.
And now, you know, Solaris imprints. Solaris Rebellion.
Right.
That's a new one.
Rebellion is like the umbrella company, and they do games and they do comics and stuff, as I understand it. But then Solaris is the publishing arm that does genre fiction.
Yeah, and it's actually fairly, given that it's genre fiction, highbrow.
Oh, I like to hear that. I have not heard that phrase before. Not that I would say it wasn't, but I have not heard that phrase before.
That's just my comment. I'm not.
That's great.
And just to name an imprint after one of the greatest science fiction books ever written, ever published, and all that.
Right. Right.
You know, so to me, says something right there.
They know what they're talking about, hopefully. Yeah.
And I even liked both movies.
You know, I think I've only ever seen the George Clooney one. So
I know. You've only seen the remake.
Yes.
Okay.
I sort of feel like it would be a really good double night pairing to do that movie, probably the original.
It would be a good one. It would be a long, long night. The original movie is about 3 hours long.
Okay. But, you know, these days, it feels like every movie is at least 2 hours long, at least two and a half hours long.
It's a very, very short Russian film.
Uh-huh. Right, exactly.
So 3 hours, that's a short Russian
film. That's right. They barely scratch the surface on that one.
Yes, exactly. they can keep going. But that is by Andrei Tarkovsky and is one of the greatest science fiction films ever made.
Yes, this is what I've been told.
And Steven Soderbergh remade, he didn't really remake that film. He took the Stanislaw Lem novel and made his own movie. And I thought, you know, what people have been saying about West Side Story, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah,
the Spielberg. But I intend to. And it's sort of like that, is that you... Except in this case, the better known auteur was the Russian.
Right, right.
As not to put down Steven Soderbergh.
Better known, I think, is probably relatively speaking. I'm sure he was better known, A, in Russia, and B, among film enthusiasts. But I imagine among the masses of America, the teeming masses in America going to the movie, probably Soderbergh.
The teeming masses of America trickle to Tarkovsky at museum shows, and he's on Turner Classic Movies a lot.
No, yeah, I'm not saying nobody knows him. I'm just saying, like, if we had to... Recognizability, I would think that Soderbergh is probably a bit more in America, at least.
Yeah, do they still use Q ratings?
Oh, you know, if they don't, they should. Well, the thing is, I think that, you know, celebrity itself has changed so much in the past 20 years because there's all sorts of streaming celebrities and YouTube celebrities and the concept of what, and everything is very niche these days. So, you know, you and I can sit here and talk about well-known directors, there's all sorts of people out there who are only known to the YouTube audience, for example, or only known to, you know, small slivers who are very famous in that area. And how do you curate that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that may be one reason it might have gone by the wayside.
Yeah, that may very well be. But it was useful.
Mm-hmm.
And so at any rate, each one, it's an interesting story. Basically, Tarkovsky saw Kubrick's ultimate science fiction masterpiece in cinema, 2001, which I don't think I'm going out on a huge limb or spacewalk by saying the best science fiction film ever made, period, bar none.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's safe to say.
Now, Tarkovsky saw that, and in his hot-blooded Russian said, this is so cold.
Mm.
And
well, it is.
Well, yes.
It's very cold.
A Stanley Kubrick movie cold is merely accurate. You know, that's
exactly.
He strove for it, tried for it. But Tarkovsky, now the novel, the Polish novel has a lot of issues, positive issues, and deals with a lot of things and draws you all the way through it. And it's very emotional and has all kinds of stuff. So Tarkovsky, adoring the Lem novel and knowing that he could probably get away with a little bit of and made this masterpiece of a movie showing that science fiction could be hot.
Okay.
That very emotional and all that, and yet using a lot of the great technique that Kubrick uses in making a film.
Yeah.
And the two of them are rather comparable. They'd each take a long time to make movies, et cetera, et cetera. So they're really sort of a pairing of movies. They're only about 4 years apart.
Right.
And it takes a while to make.
Yeah. Well, you can definitely see the influences for sure. And of course, Kubrick's, the look of Kubrick's film also is hugely influential in sci-fi.
Yeah.
Forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And Steven Soderbergh, never one to hide away from a challenge, decided to remake, or rather make his own version of Solaris.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Solaris is a book that deals, as I said, with a lot of issues.
Right.
And as such, Soderbergh managed to make a movie that was in no way redundant to the Tarkovsky film. Basic elements are there. I mean, the David Lynch Pearl movie has much more in common with the Villeneuve movie than the Tarkovsky Solaris and the Soderbergh Solaris.
Well, I think that's an interesting thing to point out too, because there's always, I was just thinking about this the other day, you know, there's this ongoing discussion. Oh, the movie was, you know, the movie wasn't as good as the book and all of that kind of stuff. And people are constantly making that kind of comparison. And of course, if you're going to the movie, having read the book, thinking you're going to see, you know, this visual cliff notes of what you just saw, I think people are going to be invariably disappointed because all these subplots and nuances, it's hard to get them in a 2 hour or even a 3 hour adaptation. We're getting maybe a little bit closer with the limited series that show up on Netflix or whatever these days. But even still, you know, it's two different art forms. I sort of cringe whenever that comment comes up because it's, you can't really do the same thing. Just like I had to write a book of a movie I just saw, like, okay, now go write the book of this movie. It still wouldn't feel the same because if nothing else, you'd probably add in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, which is what Arthur C. Clarke did.
Yeah.
2001. He did not write a book and Kubrick based on it. Kubrick wrote two versions of the script and then brought in Clarke for the third version.
Right.
And then Clarke turned it into a novelization.
Right, which I think
he added Moonwatcher, he added He changed the end of the movie.
Yeah, and I think, but I think that that's good, though. I like that because then we have like this sort of central concept and having two artists riff on it. I think that's a much more interesting thing than somebody who takes a book and tries to make it page for page for page.
Yeah.
Because you can't succeed anyway. You're always going to disappoint the audience. I remember there's a Cameron movie that is lesser watched than some of his other ones called The Abyss.
I like The Abyss.
I am a fan. I'm a big fan of The Abyss. I love the humanity of it. You know, I really just love how it all tied together. And I liked it so much the first time I saw it. I did get the novelization, which was written by Orson Scott Card. Now, I know he's on the outs with a lot of people these days, so I'm not here to praise Card.
But not for his writing or novelizations.
Right. Well, and this particular book, I really like because he did expand the story in places. He must have gotten either permission to do it or he had an expanded script or who knows what. But I thought the book was actually really a nice way to illuminate this movie I had already enjoyed. And then when I went back, I remembered sections of the book that are not in the movie, and I enjoyed the movie again in a different way. So anyway, that's the movie that I thought did well by having a book adjacent to it as opposed to, you know, being adapted from a book.
Yeah. So did you read the novel, Solaris?
No. No, I have not.
Well, it's a great novel.
I feel like now I should, though, because I'm actually coming out on this you know, from this publishing house that's named itself from it. I'm like,
Oh, exactly.
Maybe I need to be more up on things.
Yes. That's where this conversation came from.
Right.
That your book is from Solaris Publishing. And it's good reading. It's dense reading. It's good rereading. And what was amazing, what was absolutely amazing, yes, Amy Goldschlager says, I bet Jim is thinking of Charlie Pellegrino, who did go diving with Cameron. And yes, Amy is absolutely right. So at any rate.
Yes.
the discussion, which maybe we'll get to back to after we talk about your work and hear some of your writing. We also have a couple of other things on the agenda. About adaptations, I think you would have a very interesting take on what's been going on in media during the pandemic in terms of how they're adapting things and the new form of streaming and how that's changing storytelling.
Yeah.
And and they're remaking things that have been made as movies, but need more time and using the streaming platform to do it.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, the film format, I think, is best supported by shorter stories. You know, short stories, novellas, I think, can work in the film. If you try to adapt an entire novel, I think you're going to give short shrift to it. And so being able to have a multi-episode, perhaps limited series. Not every series needs to have multiple seasons, but having a multi-episode limited series, I think, can really do justice to a book. I was actually talking with my husband the other night. He's a big Harry Potter fan, and we have been finishing that documentary that's on HBO, and he's much more of a fan of that universe than I am. I have nothing against it. Well, not to leap on the comments here, but, you know, Carol Geisander has just written about, you know, once they have adaptations, doesn't the author have very limited voice? I think that's usually very true. I think authors are having a bit more input than they used to. I think that, if I remember correctly, Rowling is an executive producer. For whatever that means, that might just be a figurehead thing.
No, she was very hands-on.
So I think she got to be more hands-on. Then there's authors like Gillian Flynn, who did Gone Girl, and I believe she wrote the whole screenplay. So that's then there's, I can't think of the guy's name, but he did The Perks of Being a Wallflower. And not only did he write it, I think he wrote the book, he wrote the screenplay, and he directed it. So sometimes you can really get your hand. I don't know how you do that. I don't know how you get that kind of clout when you're signing the deal. But
if it's Harry Potter, you write your own deal.
Right, you can write your own ticket. But I guess to circle back, why I even brought it up in the first place is my husband Maury was we were watching this documentary, and he said, "I wonder if they'll go back now and try and do a streaming version of all these books, where you get one season per book, a la Game of Thrones." And I said, "You know, it's not impossible, but I personally would rather they direct efforts elsewhere, because the books and the movies are done. Like, they were good. They were just great for what they are."
But there's also a play to adapt.
Right. Yeah. There's the whole play to adapt.
Yeah. I mean, it's running on Broadway right now in 1 3-hour adaptation. If you go to England and see the original version of the play from the National Theater, it was in 2 parts and ran just short of 6 hours.
Right. It's the Cursed Child, right?
Yeah. Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. Right. And it's very interesting, the possibility of making that as a movie, because the actors, the three primary, are all the correct age now to play the parents of the protagonists of the story, which is everybody's offspring.
Right. We have to wonder, I mean, they're obviously very pleasant in the documentary, but you have to wonder how much of them in their private moments would like to actually revisit those characters. You know, I think mentally, that as much as they love them, my guess is they put them to bed. I'd be very surprised if they wanted to go back and recreate them.
I don't think so. Rupert Grint has been doing philanthropical work and various things. Emma Watson is having a decent career, and Radcliffe has been doing great theater. I saw him in a National Theater production that they, you know, show in movie theaters of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead.
Right.
From Stoppard, which is one of my all-time favorite plays. He was great.
You know, it's edifying that all three of them have had some sort of career. I mean, Grint has been appearing, or was appearing, in Servant on Apple for a while.
Right.
Not sure. I haven't seen the second season, so I don't know if he's in the second
season. Yeah, I don't subscribe to Apple.
But yeah, I mean, he's gotten work. They've all gotten work, and you know, I like the choices that Radcliffe has been making in terms of his films. He did the biggest thing possible.
Army Man.
Sorry?
With the exception of Swiss Army Man.
Oh, well, yeah, that was weird. That was just, you know, there's weird for the sake of weird, and that was just over the top. But yeah.
And I really enjoy the TV series he's doing with Steve Buscemi.
Right. That's the heaven one, or the god one. Is that
Well, it's a totally different plot every season.
Oh, okay.
In the very first one, Steve Buscemi plays God.
Right.
And it's very Douglas Adams in its way.
Good. Okay.
And Radcliffe is this bureaucrat, and God is nuts.
Right.
Well,
we watched, I watched part of the first season. I didn't get around to getting the second season yet. There's just too much TV. You know, when we bring up stuff and I'm like, oh, I haven't seen that, or I haven't read that. Just, there's too much out there. There's just, it's impossible to see.
As long as it doesn't jump channels, depending on whether it's a streamer or a creator, like if it's on HBO, it's never leaving HBO.
Right. Amy points out it's called Miracle Workers. I like having Amy here. She's like the puppet master.
and there's this woman who's also a lead in Miracle Workers whose work I don't know elsewhere, but she's absolutely wonderful. The trio are absolutely wonderful. The second season is where Steve Buscemi, his name is unsayable on the radio. He's a blank shoveler. That's his job. And as happened in medieval times, his name.
Okay.
And in the third, they're on the Oregon Trail. And Radcliffe is a priest.
Are we concerned about dysentery yet? Because, you know, everybody dies of dysentery.
Oh, yeah. There's a little bit of that, not too much, thank
you. Okay.
But they're well, it's very, very bizarre.
Right.
So each season is totally different. Mm-hmm. And Miracle Workers was a novel by
some guy. And that's just the first season. Totally different plots.
Good.
Totally different.
I respect that. I'm really happy.
Becomes an anthology.
Uh-huh.
What do you call it? I mean, if it's a different show every episode, like Outer Limits or...
Right, well, that's a different... That's one kind of anthology. But then there's this, you know, Ryan Murphy kind of set us up with all the American Horror Stories. He rotates a lot of the cast, but they're in different positions and it's a different story. And I like that. I'm really happy that we have the kind of television these days that gives us the flexibility to tell stories that way, because you like seeing the same faces, but we all know that after a certain amount of rotations, the storytelling can get creaky and everybody can get very, you know, calcified in their characters. And I like what they do with that. So I'm really glad we have that.
And in some cases, they just go ahead in the fourth season or third season, in the case of Man in the High Castle, they just kill off the lead.
Right. Well, there's that too.
And then all of a sudden you go, ooh, my response to that Man in the High Castle is, I've never watched season four. I probably never will.
Mm.
It was just a bit too much, and they had deviated too far from the Philip K. Dick.
Right. Well, I didn't go that far into the series, but one thing I would say about this whole sort of adaptation discussion that we're having is, if you're going to do a TV show that is an adaptation of a single book as opposed to a series, by the time you've gotten to the fourth or fifth season, you know, it's different. It's a new product. It's a totally different thing. And you just kind of have to, as much as you can, release your heart from the original, because they've now stretched this so far that it's either going to break or they're just going to have to reinvent things. And
So
if you can do that, then I appreciate that. But not everybody can do that successfully.
Yeah. And or you take the very premise. Mm-hmm. You take the author's world building.
Right.
And you discard the plot.
Yeah.
And you write your own plot in the author's world.
Right, which is kind of what has happened with Handmaid's Tale at this point.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, in that case, not for the better.
Yeah, I really feel like it's gotten, like, a lot of it I wanted to see. I wanted to see her, you know, escape. I wanted her to see her get back to her life. And I like the idea that they're showing her not as just settling back and being happy mom and everything. I like all of that, but I feel like they've really kind of lost the direction of what the point of it was in the first place.
Yeah. It's certainly not related to anything Margaret Atwood ever thought of.
Right. But she is an executive producer. So, you know.
Okay. Now, about that. It means largely that they have veto power and that they get an extra helping of money.
Yeah.
When the shares go out.
Right.
Now, when I interviewed Lev Grossman right after the first season of The Magicians.
Okay, yeah.
Been broadcast on TV.
Right.
And I'm a huge fan of his trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thoroughly enjoyed the TV series.
Mm-hmm.
And he is listed as an executive producer.
Right.
And I asked him, just what do you do? And he says, oh, they phone me about twice a year and tell me what they're planning on doing. The only time that he had a major decision, possibility of a veto, was in the fourth season when they were doing something radically different.
I think I know what you're talking about, too.
I made reference to it obliquely earlier, and I don't want to mention it because everybody should read the book and watch that show. They're very different.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll see characters you like in different situations.
Yeah.
But they did something with one character where they switched from vanilla to chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something made something radically different about it, and they asked Lev's permission, which granted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know,
other than that, he really didn't have a lot to do with the show.
Right, and I think that I think we all totally understand that on some level, the executive producer thing is a sop to the author so that the author doesn't go run crying in public and going, this is the worst thing ever. Don't ever watch this. This betrays my book, because their name's on it and they're getting money from it. I think we totally get that.
And I assume it gives them a little bit of veto power.
Right. And I think they benefit by being able to go to him and say, look, we're not sure about this character. What would you do? And maybe he can expand on that sort of thing. So I know that it's not as though they're running the show. I get that. But it is better than not being consulted at all. It's better than having the book, you know, the book's rights taken away from you.
Yeah. And then there's the Neil Gaiman method, which is stretch yourself so thin.
Just do everything.
Do everything. You know?
And that has 48 hours in every day.
And he is a good script writer and all that. But sometimes I think some of the work based on his work suffers for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of Good Omens without Terry Pratchett
mm-hmm.
just doesn't appeal to me.
Well, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the mini. I'm very curious about what the second one's going to be like.
No, I mean, it hasn't been filmed yet.
No, not yet.
So that's what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
I liked the first one. Mm-hmm. Yes. It was fun. It was well cast. But season two, I mean, that was the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
They finished it.
Yes, they did. And there was no plan, I think, for a two, as far as I know.
Oh, no, they're yeah.
Well, I know in TV there is, but had they planned a book?
I doubt it, but knowing Gaiman, why not?
Well, because he probably moved on to something else, and they probably both moved on.
He's also supposed to be writing
Sandman.
Another American Gods.
Uh-huh.
In prose.
Right.
He's got somebody who we probably all know doing research on finding gods for him. He'll write the story.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, people should, like, you know, send him information about what obscure gods would really work. So he's God knows how many projects he's got going.
Yeah, he's his own cottage industry at the moment.
He really is. And I think he sleeps in a different cottage every night.
He's really a super nice guy, though. I mean, like, I have nothing at all bad to say about Neil Gaiman. You know, if he can work that magic, then he should work that magic. And I'm
all hey,
we need more Gaiman, not less.
One person says, how's his Gormenghast going? I didn't know he was doing an adaptation of Gormenghast. One has already been done.
Uh-huh.
Years ago, Mervyn Peake first of all, the original adaptation of Gormenghast was by WBAI. it was. Baird Searles did a trilogy of radio dramas
mm-hmm.
that actually covered one book.
Yep.
And it was pretty darn good. The TV show with Stephen Fry and getting the name of the lead actor who has since become very popular.
Hugh Laurie.
No. an A-list heartthrob actor. Gormenghast is not, there's satire, but mm-hmm. it's not Fry and Laurie, hardly.
Right, I didn't think so.
Yeah. But there was a TV version already done that wasn't bad.
Mm-hmm.
I think Neil Gaiman would script a better version of it. I think right. that one would be an upgrade. But not everything Neil writes is adapted well.
Right. So did we want to, are there other, I mean, we can just waffle on, I'm sure.
Well, no, there are a couple of things we have.
Yeah.
I didn't even mention. One of them is that we do have a movie review from Dan Persons this morning. And you know what? I think we're going to play that right now.
Okay.
Now, the radio audience heard it. Unfortunately, the Facebook and YouTube audience
mm-hmm.
Will not.
Okay. Sorry, guys.
On the other hand, the radio audience won't get to see us. So,
oh, okay. Right.
So do both.
Right.
We'll now say thank you, Dan. We are back. There's another thing that we're going to have to do
mm-hmm.
is going to have to talk a few minutes about WBAI's survival. But before we do that, let's talk about our reading series.
Yeah, let's do that.
So what you are seeing or hearing, folks, are two-thirds of the regular, as opposed to pop-up, reading series in New York. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, started by Gordon Van Gelder in the year 1822. I've been recording them from the beginning. I took over the series, I don't know how long ago, 13, 14 years ago. I'm the, as I put it, I'm the eighth doctor. Lisanne Lake says, I love the PBS version of Gorman Guest. That's the one we were talking about, actually. It was a BBC, and as is typical, they took our tax money, sent it to England, and then we get it on PBS.
Oh, that's how we like it, though.
You know what? I want my tax money to go to American producers, and I want the BBC to, you know, I'll rent it the same way I get HBO.
Mm-hmm.
I'll subscribe to the BBC, but if my tax dollars are going to PBS, I want to see what Americans produce. Apple Hills?
Ample Hills, yeah. Apple. Sorry, I didn't know that's what you were struggling for. Yeah, so I run this the reading series at Ample Hills Creamery, which is an ice cream place you can find in a couple of different places around the city. We are based in the Gowanus section because there's another one elsewhere in Brooklyn. So just to differentiate, once a month, every third Tuesday, we have three writers, sometimes four, who share about 20, 25 minutes of their work. And it's and they sell books, and you can get them signed. You can get books signed, and it's a great way to just sort of get together. There is an outdoor section, which is why it's called Rooftop Readings at Ample Hills. There's also an indoor section for when the weather is just horrible. And we've been abiding by all the COVID concerns and everything. Everybody's masked except the readers when they're doing their reading up on the stage. We've
been doing this. Their identity. No, sorry.
No. There's no eye masks. It's not Zorro. Well, when Zorro comes, we'll tell him. We've been doing this since we were supposed to do it starting in March of 2020, and we can all figure out what happened there.
Perfect timing.
Exactly. So we had to cancel all of those, and we started up again in May of 21, and we did. It was great. It was so cool. We got a lot of really good audience members, a bunch of regulars. It's a ticketed event, so the idea is you buy your ticket, it costs $10. You get admission to the reading, but also you get two scoops of ice cream from Ample Hills. So for a lot of people, that is the reason to go. I mean, you know, it's like great authors, great readings, great chance to meet them, and you get ice cream on top of it.
Unless you're diabetic.
Well, yes.
That was my problem. I went to one of the first ones.
Right, right.
And no, it wasn't. It was your birthday.
Yeah.
Wasn't that the first event I went to there?
Well, that would have been in November. Did you come to the? I don't remember you at the November one.
Yes.
Oh my God. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and but the problem is trying to deal with some their technical issues here on the video side. The problem is that they have no low sugar options of anything. There's no low sugar ice cream.
Right.
There's no. And everything there is ice cream.
Yeah, they do have vegan versions, but I'm not sure if that would qualify as low
sugar. Vegan versions tend to put in
more sugar.
Yes.
Got it.
Because since they take certain flavors out,
right,
they figure more sugar.
So we had really, really amazing authors last year. It was great. We had all the way up through December. We were supposed to have one on this upcoming Tuesday. And unfortunately, because of the Omicron concerns and the fact that it's January and people are not necessarily thinking about ice cream, we decided to cancel this particular month. So we're not going to do it this month, but we do have next month. And I should have probably pulled this up earlier, but hold on a second. And I will tell you we are going to be having who we're going to be having at the Ample Hills reading. In February. So here it is. Let's see. So in February, we're going to be having authors David Mack and Liz Braswell and David Fisher. And I was trying to sort of...
We've met David Mack a few times. The other two, we have not.
Well, I wanted to do, as much as I can, I'm trying to do some sort of themes, like if we're going to have a science fiction night or a fantasy night or a mystery night or whatever. So I'm trying to do themes as much as possible. It's not always possible to do that, but in this particular case, I wanted to do a kind of Hollywood night. So all three of them have either written books that were adapted or they consult by Hollywood with Hollywood, or they consult with Hollywood, or they've written about Hollywood figures. So that's kind of this theme for February. And I'm hoping that it will be a little bit less scared of Omicron and people will be more interested in coming out for some ice cream.
Let's knock wood.
Yeah, exactly.
Since March 20, we had a great pre-pandemic event where Barbara Krasnoff, my partner, went up to, Connecticut.
Oh, Connecticut.
Near Mystic.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and did a reading there, which was wonderful, and we came back. They announced, it's pandemic, and I've been out of the house maybe 15, 20 times since, not for a haircut. Mostly just to see doctors and two engineering shifts at WBAI in the last month, which I must say were a total fright. And I think both management and myself agree that I won't be doing a third. But that has enabled me to go into the station and do the show live, but we're not doing that. I'm not doing that this week.
Right.
Probably not next. I'm going to pre-record, or we're going to figure out a way I can do it remotely because the control room there is, which you've been in, small airless room, and you're talking into a windscreen, which is a piece of foam. What better way to collect people's germs than to share that foam on the mic? I keep meaning to write a little email to the powers that be at the radio station saying, can we get more windscreens, please? So I'm not using the same one as the last person. So I'm going to record, as we are doing right now,
a
little bit more.
Right.
So on the NIRSIF readings, we went virtual almost immediately using the exact same software that you and I are using right now to record, because that lets me simulcast to both Facebook and YouTube. And I could do LinkedIn, but why bother? You know, really. If the writer, if it would help their career.
Right.
Sure, we'll do that.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we're doing it this way. Their software is improving all the time.
Great.
But December was just nerds. And, God, I'm sorry, we're getting Fire Sign Theater commercials in the chat channels here. Shoes for the dead. WBAI listeners, old-time listeners, should recognize that. And no doubt I will be playing that. It's a Hugo Award nominee. I should mention Don't Crush a Dwarf and Hand Me the Pliers, and I think we're all bozos on this bus. But, you know, we're for best dramatic presentation, but one of them lost to some movie called 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Oh, that guy again.
And that guy again. But the other one lost to Clockwork Orange.
Right. That guy again.
That guy again. Exactly.
He's everywhere.
Yeah. And, you know, they really need to create an audio award, not a podcast award. Mm-hmm. I can't get in there because I'm radio.
Right.
Which annoys me.
Yes. You need to speak to the powers that be, I guess. Whoever those are.
There aren't any. You know, it's the Hugo Awards. They're self-voting.
Right, but is there no way of creating a new category, I guess, is what needs to happen.
They need to change them overall. That's true of all the awards.
Mm, yeah.
So we missed out on January.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because December was just a little bit too nuts. Amy had somebody in mind, but that fell through, and I just didn't have the wherewithal to go out and snatch people. I'm going to start booking the rest of our 31st season. Starting next week, I'm going to start booking people. And the fun thing about being virtual is that you can go anywhere.
Right.
So we've had Jack Dan from Australia, and we had a writer from Singapore, and so on and so forth. That part of it is fun.
Mm-hmm.
Not getting together in a physical space, that's really something only you can do at this moment, usually.
Right.
When the weather isn't what it is this month, which is why you've had to postpone this month.
That's part of it, yeah. I mean, you know, I think people are, the thing is, we have the indoor space, and we have used the indoor space, and we like crack a door open or whatever, make people wear masks, and you can't come in if you're not vaxxed, but
also a consideration for us.
Yeah. So, you know, that's, it was just a lot of factors going on with this January. And like I say, we're hoping on February 15th that we will be having the next one. And, you know, if you're interested, I don't know if you can you put up that link or anything, Jim?
Yeah, sure. If I know it.
I will put it to you in the chat, and if you will.
Oh, great. Yes. Although, you know, I don't know if I can cut and paste from the chat.
Okay.
Let's see if I can.
All right, give me one second.
No, I cannot.
All right, well, it's...
Oh, but if you put it in the public chat.
Oh, okay, I can put it in the public chat. Yes, right, that's a good idea. I do not have the ability to write in the public chat. I've wanted to say something to a person or another, but I can't. I don't see how to do that. It just says public.
Okay. Come to think of it, neither can I. But there is one more thing we can do, and that is add items or something. Okay, give me the link. Tell me.
Okay. Oh, you mean tell it to you or put it in the host chat?
Tell it to me, verbal.
Okay, so the link for tickets and for information is amplehills.com.
AMPLE.
Uh-huh.
HILLS.com.
Right, /events. And then /rooftop-readings.
And now
I'm all tense with anticipation. Yay! There it is. So that's where you can find out who's going to be coming over the next few months, because we have a bunch of the months. I think we have February and March listed right now. And then you can get your tickets right there. If we don't hold it for any reason, you know, they do refund, or you have the option of using it for a future month. So, you know, don't worry about that. But the plan is, yes, we will have them continuing going forward. And as soon as the weather is nice enough, we will be doing them outdoors again.
Yeah. Okay. And Carol Geisander has given it to us.
Ah, thank you.
But for the radio audience again, it's amplehills.com/events/rooftop-readings. And we will mention it again at the end of the show.
Cool.
You know, because it's probably getting on to 7 a.m. and we don't want people falling out of their beds.
Right.
In order to write their various notes. Or maybe we do. It all depends. So KGB was going to go live. They've gone back to virtual.
Mm-hmm.
And we are not certain whether our wonderful, wonderful venue,
Brooklyn Commons
may or may not be available to us, because we shall see. Mm-hmm. I haven't spoken since the pandemic began to the owner of the space, who's also the landlady of WBAI, in the same building at 388 Atlantic Avenue. But that ground floor, which has been a cafe, has often been a problem.
Yeah.
I heard from a WBAI person that she is going to be leasing that space to a publishing company.
Interesting. The irony, the irony.
Yes, and my first thought is, oh, do they need anybody?
Exactly. We have people for you.
Yeah, you know, I can proofread, I can edit, you know. Hire me, somebody. I need the work. I need the money. And, I'm willing to work for it. So I can't announce what we don't have yet, other than we're going to, at least until the summer. Mm-hmm. Same way that Broadway shows are now putting themselves off until June. But you're outdoors, so
we're outdoors in the better weather. We're in there's a parallel space indoors for the not so good weather. We did that. I think our first indoor one was October, and then November was indoors, and December was indoors. So we had several of those, but. And they seemed to do just fine. I mean, you know, people kept a distance and they kept their masks on, and it all worked out okay.
Yeah.
But again, I think Omicron has just put another spin on things because so many people are getting it.
It really has. Doesn't Omicron sound like a Marvel villain? Anyway.
It does.
And it probably is.
Exactly.
Okay. Now the a viewer / listener comments, a publishing company with live readings. Well, there is one. We forgot to mention.
Erewhon, right?
Erewhon Press.
Right. Erewhon Press, right.
Erewhon Press, Liz Gorinsky, editor, and Martin Cahill, I think, books the readings. He's at least the publicist there.
Right.
And they've been doing good stuff.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, too. And it's a nice, comfy space. Amy points out that in July we did have an Ample Hills indoors because of the horrible weather out.
Yeah. But we'll see. The all the readings are either marking time or getting ready to continue.
And I'm hoping they all do, for sure. I mean, you know, it's nice. A reading out with the authors on an evening is a really nice thing to do.
Yeah, and you really, really get to meet people, I should add. I don't know how much Matt and Ellen agree with this, but I have said it and I'm sticking to it. My feeling about the KGB reading series is that it's like a salon. Because there isn't anybody in New York in the business you're not interested in meeting. It's fascinating people all around. Many of them professionals in the field. There's also the HWA, that's Horror Writers Association New York Galactic Terrors reading. Continue online.
Yeah, I just did something with them literally on Thursday night. It wasn't a reading, but we talked about our favorite books of the year, and it was a lot of fun. It was me, Stephen Van Patten, and oh my god, and Teal James Glenn. Yes.
Oh, that's a great trio, actually. Mm-hmm.
With hosts James Chambers and Carol Geisander.
Yeah, I'm going to have Steve Van Patten. He was on my show once.
Oh yeah, he's
wonderful.
Excellent.
Wonderful. Yeah. Big guy. Is he the one who does some stuntman work? No, it's Teal.
That's Teal. Teal
is a stuntman.
I don't think he does any anymore, but yeah, he did a lot in his day.
Yeah, yeah. And he's a good writer and he's a good reader. So anyway, that's what's going on the reading front. We're all evolving. None of us are going away, even if venues go away. Even if the NYRSIF venue goes away, this is our fourth venue. And in the worst case, we will find a fifth.
Exactly.
And until the face-to-face live readings happen, all of us are going to continue with virtual. And we should probably mention, by the way, that there are some readings from other cities – with good people, and who cares about them? We are concerned about us.
Right. Yeah.
So Apple Hills, Nursif, KGB, Galactic Terrors, Erwan Salon, the list goes on. And mm-hmm. you know what? We're not really competing for audience.
No.
People who want to go to one are willing to go to the other. My fear, and something we'll all probably get together to talk about at some point, because it was only me and then me and KGB, and we had sort of like an agreement on a 3-month buffer of readers,
mm-hmm.
That I wouldn't have anybody that they're going to have within 3 months, and vice versa. But now, so the problem may end up occurring. Oh no, we can't have Nicholas Kaufman. Nicholas Kaufman read it, all of them. I think we should have, a Nick month.
A what?
A Nick month, that he has to be one of the, that he should take one of his longer stories and start it.
Start it in one and continue.
One reading and continue, and we'll all fight in the background for who gets to get the final few pages.
I'll tell him his name came up. He'll be tickled.
No, I think it's a great idea. It's nothing long, just 10 minutes.
A movable reading feast.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. A movable Kaufman feast.
That's right.
He might just enjoy that.
I do.
Okay, so we have two more pieces of business uh-huh. that are musts. One of them is that you're going to read for us.
Okay.
But the other one is that I have to do a little bit of pitching.
Okay.
Because this is going to be a major shock to all. Mm-hmm. At WBAI, we pitched all through December to pay for the transmitter fees and things. And the shock, not what you hear from us usually, is we made our goal, which is not usually the case. We made 58 grand. And so, given that we have another year to face and very limited capabilities of going out into the community and raising money, we are continuing, doubling down and moving the goal from 58,000 to 100,000. And we need to finish that in the month of January. And things are going well, but that's because we're taking time out from shows like I'm doing right now, and explaining to people that WBAI had once again gotten itself into fierce financial ills, I will say, not because of our own fault. And why? Well, part of that is actually being adjudicated right now mm-hmm. in New York State courts, mm-hmm. by the Attorney General, that involving liability between our owners and ourselves and local control. But suffice it to say, October 2019, our owners came in and shut us down mm-hmm. for a month. We were paying $65,000 a month on rent in the Empire State Building on a contract we did not agree to. Our owners in California agreed to it. And the story then went out that of the 5 Pacifica listener-sponsored radio stations, we were the one taking all the money. Until it turned out maybe that's not the case. And that there were financial problems in California, which have been going through the courts. And other stuff. The point is, it does cost more to broadcast out of New York. We're out of the Empire State Building now. We're at 4 Times Square in what I believe is the Reuters Building the AP Building. It's a news source. and much, much, much less expensive. Our landlady at 388 Atlantic Avenue is an old-time progressive lefty and big supporter herself of WBAI. So we're getting a prorated rent. We've also lost a lot of space that we had. And the downstairs was not a part of it. That was a separate deal. In fact, I was doing the nearest of readings downstairs before WBAI moved into that building. But we both had the same source of contact. So we need very seriously to make very serious money this month. And I am asking you, the viewer and the listener, to call right now, even if you're watching this later on YouTube or Facebook or WBAI broadcasting at 99.5 FM or streaming at WBAI.org. I'd like you to become a BAI buddy. And that means that you pay on the installment plan. You pay $25 a month instead of just giving that lump sum. Okay, you can make it up $10, by the way. You can name your price. And you do it by phoning area code 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. I didn't create a crawl for that, but Amy, maybe you could just type that in, 212-209-2950, or you can go to, and this one is simple, so we don't need to put it on the screen, WBAI.org, and follow the links to become a subscriber, give money, it will ask you what your favorite show is, and we know it's Hour of the Wolf, right? We know. So, but the important thing is that you help contribute, you help keep us alive. We always say now more than ever, okay? And yes, it's now more than ever. We need your support. Actually, it's less this month than last month because people heeded the clarion call that was put out, and I can't thank people enough. Now, as long as you pay that pledge, we'll be a little closer to becoming solvent. So this is not, I know that people generally want to hear, we're doing so badly, you've got to pledge, you've got to do it. Sorry, we did well last month. You gave us support. And that has helped a great deal. It's not only helped in terms of our finances, but it's helped us producers in terms of morale. It's like, oh my God, we're not necessarily going away immediately. So right now, we're in the situation where we have only a few people who actually can go into the station and operate things because it's a rather air, you know, there's no heavy air conditioning. It's not generally desired in the studio to have that noise in the background. So we're all trying to do the show virtually. I have the choice of going in and doing it live because I was an announcer. So but I'm still trying to stick to home, and there's another factor. Let's just say, not everybody who works in that radio station is jabbed. So I want to stay away from unjabbers until Omicron goes away. So once again, folks, 212-209-2950, or do it the old-fashioned way. Get a browser. and go to WBAI.org and pledge your support and help aid not only WBAI, but this radio show, Hour of the Wolf, now in a new format, in a new time slot. For the first time in a while, we are back in the Hour of the Wolf, 6 to 8 a.m., especially on a Sunday. 6 to 8 is Varg Timan. It's an old, old Roman myth that it's a magical time. People are born, people die. Ingmar Bergman made a movie called Varg Timan, Hour of the Wolf. The radio show is named after the movie. Margot Adler created the show, and since the time then was 5 to 7, it was during Varg Timan. And even though I may move around a little, in the last 2 years I've had like 4 or 5 different time slots, I'm again in Varg Timan. I'm again in Hour of the Wolf. So, very pleased to be there. Our program director calls it a pilot. So, also, your support helps Hour of the Wolf to prove that, yes, we can build an audience in this time slot. So, again, last time for this moment, 212-209-2950 or WBAI.org. Thank you. I'm sorry, Randy, but we need to stay alive.
Hey, I get it. I totally understand. I'm a public radio supporter in various different forms.
Yeah, and we are public radio, but we are not government-supported radio.
Right. Right.
Well, like NPR or PBS, we get some bills paid for by mm-hmm. the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Right.
They cover our music.
Right.
Which is a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it wasn't for them, we'd be playing only public domain tunes.
It would be very limited.
Yeah, but we're not actually getting money from them. They're just paying a huge bill for right. us. Actually, for all nonprofit 501c3 radio stations, they don't single Pacifica or WBAI out.
Mm-hmm.
Take care of it for everybody. So I always have to give that caveat. But otherwise, we invented listener sponsorship in 1946.
Oh, it's you. Oh, you're the ones.
We're the ones. A gentleman by the name of Lew Hill, L-E-W Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And if people want to know more details, there is a monograph he wrote, two monographs. One is called Pacifica, therefore the Pacifica Foundation. And, I'm going to ask you and the viewing audience the trivia question, but and Pacifica now has 5 stations. So Pacifica, what major science fiction franchise series, arguably at this moment the largest one, is in Pacifica, California? I'm always amazed. David Mack would know.
I mean, you know, am I supposed to say an answer? Or
Star Trek? You should type it in.
Star Trek? I can't type it in.
It's Star Trek.
Okay.
Absolutely Star Trek. Heather Aronson knew that. But yes, Starfleet headquarters, and well, it got blown up by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Well, it's not there anymore then, is it?
Yeah, but that's that's the alternate Star Trek universe.
Right, of course.
If you go back to the real Federation, they mention it any number of times. It's where Wes went to school and all that. Star mm-hmm. Trek, Starfleet headquarters.
Right.
Pacifica, California. And why? Because of listener-sponsored radio.
That's right. That's what it is.
Yes. So when you donate, remember the future.
You're supporting the Federation.
Right. A good one.
Yes.
The Kelvin universe.
Right, right.
Is, leave it to Amy. I bet she typed that one up to find out. What do you write, Randy, when you're in terms of fiction? How would you, or would you, typify your fiction in any particular way?
I like blending the fantastical with the realistic. So, you know, they call it urban fantasy or whatever, urban horror or whatever you want to call it. But I like putting things in a recognizable context most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I like the blending of what we're very familiar with, we as people, human beings, and how that intersects with the fantastical.
Okay. So,
yeah. So that's probably as much of a nugget as I could give you.
Okay. Do you aim for humor, for drama, for cliffhangers?
I aim for people to pick up the book and keep reading it. That's what I aim for. I mean, you know, I have written a humorous novel. I have written some humorous short stories. I've written some darkly humorous stuff. I like humor, but I also have, you know, deadly serious books and stories and things like that as well. So, you know, if what I write, if people want to read more of it, I'll probably write more of that. But you know, I try to cover the spread.
Yeah. By the way, I do want to say Amy Goldschlager writes something saying Jim hates anime. That is generally true, but Jim has been avidly watching and enjoying. Oh, it was just made into a live action series and got canceled.
What, Cowboy Bebop?
Cowboy Bebop.
Mm-hmm.
And what that live series did for me is I watched it and that made me watch the anime.
Oh, okay.
I'm thoroughly enjoying the anime.
Cool.
Other way, you know, and maybe that will be my way in. but I don't know. I've watched other anime that has basically, including Miyazaki, and a lot of it has left me cold. I think I have to watch Spirited Away again because I think the problem is I didn't get it.
I could be wrong, and I'm speaking from a place of ignorance, but I don't consider Miyazaki to be anime. I consider him to do animation films. Anime, I feel like, is a separate universe kind of thing, and I'm not really sure how to exactly separate the two of them, but Miyazaki is not somebody I would necessarily put in the anime category.
That's interesting. Most people tend to.
Hmm.
And Amy, of course, says Cowboy Bebop is the anime gateway drug.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably a fair statement. But having said that, I digressed again.
this whole show is a bunch of digression.
Well, that's my mind. That's the state of my mind, and that's therefore freeform radio.
Exactly.
Exactly. So, having said all this about your writing,
mm-hmm.
If you want, we can take a break and then you can read, or you can just start reading. How long is your reading?
I think it should take about 15 minutes. That sounds about right. I did a general timing on it. You wanted me to have a complete story. So I have a complete story. I could go much shorter if we had a shorter, you know, excerpt section, but if you can do 15 minutes, then that should probably cover this.
Yeah, I think we can do 15 minutes. And I'm shocked at how long we've actually been talking. It's already about an hour 15 minutes.
I know.
So yeah, so let's go to the fiction, and then we will probably take a musical break. I'm going to be producing this tonight.
Okay.
And we will continue at that point. So I'm giving you the virtual floor. I'm getting out of here.
Well, are you going to show the book, show the whatever or whatever?
Yes, I have to reload it. I don't know how it got unloaded, but it'll be up in a minute.
Oh, okay. So should I just begin or?
You should.
Okay. Hi, everybody. my show now. So this is a short story that I wrote for a book. You'll see the cover of it in just a moment. The book is called New York, Give Me Your Best or Your Worst. It features photos by Elizabeth Crowens, who also edited the book. And it came out late last year. She got a special grant from the New York City Arts Program or whatever it is they were trying to do. And she was able to put this book together in record time. So she gave me a picture of this woman that she had taken, a real picture of this woman with two dogs, and said, hey, I know you like writing about dogs. Here's a prompt for you. So I used that as the prompt for this story, which is a little on the weird side and apparently has confused my mother. She read it. She's like, I don't know what this is about. So you can tell me what you think afterward. So here's the story. Paul Hemus and Fisk and Maud and the Mayor by Randy Dawn. Maud Alucard had been the mayor of New York City for nearly 3 minutes, and no one had noticed. No one except Paul Hemus and Fisk. But Paul Hemus and Fisk, who'd named themselves after Brooklyn streets Maud had bicycled them through daily, were cognizant of her ascendancy to the top of the political heap in the world's greatest city because, well, they were the ones who had elected her. Well executed, Fisk nodded at his companion, who he could only perceive in a soft outline as they were trapped in a darkened closet. He licked his chops, retrieving a whisper of tonight's dinner from a fine curl above his muzzle. And 'twas the right decision. Something had to be done. Polly twitched her forelegs, approximating a shrug. When do you suppose they'll figure it out? Any moment, my dear. Only Fisk wasn't entirely sure about this. What he was clear on was that the guffawing, murderous Mayor de Bellefonde, in whose campaign headquarters closet they currently cowered, had to go. Further, he knew deep down, past his fur and into his bones, that Maud, loyal and clear-headed Maud, would be a better leader. Even further, he was aware on a nose-twitching, instinctual level that he and Polly were in perfect agreement on both of these subjects. And the moment they had made their mutual decision to swap the city's elected leadership, everything had gone quite silent on the other side of the door. Hearing nothing, sensing nothing, Fisk braced his forepaws on the door and caught the knob with his teeth, giving it a twist. Not even latched, he told his companion, and the door swung open a few inches. Two sets of deep brown eyes and two matching white muzzles poked outside, staring at the humans in the room just beyond. No one was moving. The new mayor of New York held a paper coffee cup in one hand, its contents suspended in midair as she thrust her arm forward. The ex-Mayor de Bellefonde, architect of his own downfall, stood in the arc of the oncoming liquid. His pink lips were spread back mid-laugh, a giant har, har, har emerging from them. He was utterly unaware of the dark roasted bath he was about to receive. Around them, several other workers on the committee to re-elect Mayor D.B. were stilled in various poses, balancing a donut box, cradling a phone, covering their mouths in shock. It was like looking at a picture on the wall, not real life. They ain't moving, Polly twitched her dark nose. Did we break them? Fisk shook his head, ears flopping. He had no idea what they'd just done, only that Mayor D.B.'s actions had demanded an immediate response. How dare he attempt to drag them away from their beloved Maud? They'd managed to escape his meaty grasp, dashing into a supply closet, only to have the red-faced politician slam the door behind them. Well, that was untenable. So they'd come to an instant mutual agreement, and the deed was done. Maud was now in charge. But in the expanding moments since they'd elevated Maud, nothing had been the same. On the other paw, with everyone around them frozen in place, nothing was different either. Polly nudged Fisk. I'm going to go over there and lay teeth on that guy. Should get things going again. Fisk cocked his head. Refrain. Bites should be reserved for extreme circumstances. This one is merely strange. A little nip, then? Fisk set his paw over hers. Patience. Sometimes it takes time for them to catch up to us. Polemus and Fisk were not your average four-legged, wiry-haired companions. They had no memory of the laboratory they'd been born in, the city inspectors who'd shut it down over health concerns, or the soft-hearted intern who'd hidden them in a one-time kiwi fruit crate rather than euthanizing them with the rest of the experimental beasts. But if one of the scientists who'd assisted in their creation had examined their genes, she would determine that they were 83% canine, 6% dolphin, 4% pig, 4% cow, and 3% unknown, possibly extraterrestrial. Early abandonment had required them to fend for themselves. While continuing to shelter in the fruit crate, tossed behind a dumpster along with unshredded lab paperwork, they'd rarely emerged from their fragrant alley next to a cafe. They'd been able to focus on the cafe workers hauling out the trash nightly, and eventually those workers started leaving out choicer bits of food they could forage. Many of the rest of their hours had been spent learning to read, decoding the squiggles in the scientific reports, and poring over newspapers that fluttered into their alley. "Mayor D.B. calls for more bike lanes," a headline shouted. "Re-election a lock for Mayor D.B.," said another. "Further arrests in Long Island Franken Labs," read another. Fisk preferred pages from The Times, Paul Hemus, The Post. Yet they got along. One morning, they'd woken with ice crystals coating their curls and made their first shared decision. "We gotta get inside." Being a stray had romantic moments, but now was the time for practicality. Humans had control of indoors, so they would adopt a human, one with potential. They'd undertaken careful neighborhood reconnaissance, but the pickings were slim. This one had children who yanked on Polly's ears, a near-nipping offense. That one had refused to share a bite of cruller, despite Fisk's much-practiced wide-eyed pleading stare. Another couple had flinched away in fear, yelping about a man named Al Lurgic. After weeks, they despaired of finding someone suitable. Then she showed up. A narrow woman with thick legs, she had dismounted with grace from her bicycle. Her eyes had been covered in oversized dark spectacles, leading Paul Hemus to observe, "Looks like a she-owl." Fisk's gaze had lingered first on the roomy wooden panniers that lay astride the back of her bicycle. "We could journey in those," he'd mused, then assessed the vehicle's owner. Tidy and efficient, she-owl wore her hair like a cloud, bound by a flower-printed scarf. After locking her bicycle to a metal post outside the cafe near their alley, she'd whisked inside and emerged moments later, her open thermos steaming with an earthy, nutty odor. Pausing mid-sidewalk, she sipped from the lid, tilting her head back in delight. She'd gone to a different world, having sipped a few drops of pure, unadulterated peace. Her. Polly and Fisk agreed instantly with a flick of their matted, off-white tails. Bumbling toward the she-owl, tangled and stained, they'd presented themselves for inspection at her booted feet. Us, they'd thought at her. Maud, they knew her name from the moment they'd asserted their thought, froze. Her thermos thudded to the ground. The nutty aroma of peace had dribbled down the sidewalk. Woof! Paul Hemus yipped as definitively as a puppy throat could muster. Maud gasped once, turning to the duo at her feet. Angels! She'd cried, scooping them up into her arms. So they had been joined. Thereafter, they went everywhere together, Paul Hemus and Fisk jouncing along in the sturdy wooden panniers, up and down Brooklyn's streets and avenues, promenades and parks. Maud brought them to museums and cafes, on dates and errands. They memorized the street signs they cycled past and created mental maps of the city. It was a big world, much vaster and more exciting than an alley outside a cafe, and it was theirs for the shaping. They chose their names, then thought them at Maud, who never called them Fifi and Lola again. The trio bonded in a way few pets and owners managed, with an instant understanding and coherence that was as inexplicable as it was critical. That said, sometimes Maud's attachment to them was so strong, Fisk had to gently think at her today that it was a good day to leave them in the apartment. "I will miss you, my angels," she would say on those days, and never stay away for too long. Then she'd begun volunteering for the mayor. At first, Paul Hemus and Fisk had been completely on Maud's side about the wonderful nature of Mayor de Villafond. He was 100% behind adding more bike lanes and making them wider, which Maud insisted was necessary to continue their journeys through the world's greatest city. "You two are growing by leaps and bounds," she told them one night as they curled up on the sofa. "Do we jump up too much?" Polly worried. "If I were mayor, I'd eliminate cars entirely," Maud said. She had whole platforms of ideas, usually prefaced with that phrase. "But wider lanes are a good start. I can't risk my angels getting doored." adored? Paul Hemus half wagged, twitching one eye. I believe it is when a handled rectangular barrier crashes on your skull, Fisk guesstimated, lowering his tail with a thump and panting three times. He often made things up if he didn't know the real answer. Maud herself wears a helmet to avoid such difficulties. So when she says she adores us, is she going to one day drop? You are overthinking the matter, Fisk insisted. There, a beetle is wandering on the carpet. Go have a snack. With a feral glint in her eyes, Polly pounced. If reelected, the mayor would make life easier for bicycles in the city, and therefore Paul Hemus and Fisk and Maud. There was enough that was enough to get their human to leave home three nights a week to phone bank at Mayor DB's Brooklyn headquarters. His campaign manager, Julius, generously allowed Maud to bring her companions, who rested patiently under the cave of her temporary desk as she settled in for 2 hours of calls to supporters. 1 hour in, Maud took a break to fetch a steaming cup of peace for herself and a salmon-flavored biscuit for Paul Hemus and Fisk. They felt they were doing their part, and all was well until they saw Mayor DB for the first time in the flesh, and things went quickly downhill. Mayor Bradley de Bellefond wasn't much of a specimen, in Paul Hemus and Fisk's opinion. He flung open the street-level door to the Brooklyn HQ that fateful night, his smile broad and shining, his dark hair fixed and lacquered. He carried a box of donuts and smelled of glazed sugar and cat. Strike one. Polly made the tiniest of snarls as they peered around the side of the desk. Fisk's nose twitched. That smell was somehow familiar. Maud was impressed with the newcomer and was on her feet before the door slammed shut. Yanking off her headphones, she grabbed her coffee and hurried to shake the mayor's hand. Mayor de Bellefond, she gasped, I am your greatest admirer. De Bellefond raised an eyebrow. He smoothed down his unmoving hair, neck flushing a few degrees. He opened the donut box. Well then, little lady, you get first choice of something sweet and sticky. His gaze traveled up and down Maud's entire person, longer than either Paul Hemus or Fisk had seen anyone examine her. There was something in his eye that reminded Fisk of the way Polly had stared at that beetle on the carpet just before she devoured it. Strike two, Fisk growled. That was when they made their error. Paul Hemus and Fisk emerged from beneath the desk, tails wagging tentatively, curious and protective. As soon as he spotted them, the mayor's tanned face blanched and every bit of charm fizzled out. What are they doing here? He demanded in a flat tone, shoving the donut box at his campaign manager. I told Ms. Alucard that, Julius flailed. Fisk's eyes widened. His nose twitched, drinking in that sickly sugar feline scent, beneath which was the slightest hint of fruit, of kiwi. The growl returned. He's kind of familiar, ain't he? Polly wondered. Failing to read the room, Maud lit up. These are my angels, Paul Hemus and Fisk. They found me. The mayor waved her aside. A crackle filled the air. I know these animals. And in that instant, Fisk knew Mayor DB. He'd been with them as pups when their eyes had barely opened. He'd been in a lab with needles and cages. Fisk closed his eyes and communicated to Polly the memory of the big man with the stiff hair waving his arms and shouting, Get rid of them all, now. No one can know about this. I'll be ruined. Polly panted, shivering. Fisk opened his eyes and everything in the room seemed brighter and sharper. These are wild beasts, the mayor declared. Get them out of my office immediately. He turned to Julius, whose arms were full of donut box. Fine, I'll get rid of the dirty, nasty things. Mr. de Bellefond, Maud barked. Don't you dare. Don't get hysterical, woman. The mayor brushed his hands, advancing on Paul Hemus and Fisk. He lunged. Paul Hemus and Fisk dodged, evaded, and ran into a supply closet, whose door slammed close behind them. And in his last act as mayor of the world's greatest city, Bradley de Bellefond let out a noise of triumph that sounded like a donkey caught in a vacuum cleaner. Polly was still trembling. He's a menace. We gotta do something. Yes, agreed Fisk, and I have an idea. Biting! No, Fisk told her. There is a better way. They met each other's gaze, and together they remembered Maud's wishes. If I were mayor. And so they elected her. Stepping out of the closet, Paul Hemus and Fisk padded around the frozen humans and took a seat next to Maud, haunches settling softly on the carpet. The crackle in the air around them dissipated. We never did nothing this big before, Polly noted. Fisk nodded in agreement, beginning to wonder what more they could accomplish in this vast world next. Wider bike lanes, cat exile colonies, squirrel roundups, canine massage spas. Anything was possible with Maud in charge. The world is our oyster, he thought. The humans began to unfreeze inch by inch, catching up to the dogs. Maud blinked twice. Debellafon shuddered. Phones rang. Julius stumbled backward, and Maud's coffee finally landed, splashing across Debellafon's face and tight-fitting polo shirt. Whoopsie, said Debellafon. Looks like I got in the way of your caffeine fix. Maud blinked again as if coming out of a fugue. I suppose. Julius, find this man a paper towel. Julius set the donuts down. Anything for you, Miss Mayor. That's Ms., corrected Maud. Fisk felt a wave of satisfaction settle over him and a tingle of anticipation for the future. We should start making a list of what comes next, he started to tell Polhemus. But Polly wasn't paying attention. She was already chasing another beetle across the carpet. The end. Thank you, everybody. And thank you all for listening to my story.
Yeah, and thank you so much for sharing it. So, once again, yeah, a couple of things. Number one is I'm just going to show this to the people at home because I don't want to, it's a personal pitch. Mm-hmm. I'll pay for the live events that we do online. Mm-hmm. And to the listening audience, I'll ask you to help pay for WBAI, 212-209-2950, or go to WBAI.org. So, that's what happens. As I said, I do too much when I'm engineering both online at the same time. So once again, tell us where people go for the Ample Hills information.
So it's amplehills.com /events/rooftop-readings.com. And that's where you can find out who's going to be reading and where you can get tickets. If you go to my webpage, which is randydawn.com.
And spell that, please.
RANDEEDAWN.com, kind of like the name, right?
Yeah. But
and then there's a section, it says bonus. You know, it's my own website. I had to figure out some. You go to bonus on my webpage. There's a place you can find where everybody's going to be reading. And if you're an author, if you'd like to sign up and if you want to get tickets, that's got the whole package.
Okay, great. So thank you. This is, how many times have you been on? This is your, not counting the NIRSIF.
Three, I think.
Three, okay.
Yeah,
that's right. We didn't get to discuss Get Back.
No, we did not get to that, no.
We may have to get back to discuss Get Back because I would call it Peter Jackson's second best film.
Right.
Calling Lord of the Rings one movie.
Right.
And calling Get Back another movie.
Yes, we will definitely. I have many things to say, and I would be happy to say those, and so we'll have to gather again. Hopefully we'll all see you all again closer to when Tune In Tomorrow is coming out.
Yes, and when is that exactly?
August 16th.
Okay. So, yes, we'll definitely be doing something about that time. So, thank you for being here, Randy Dawn.
Thank you for having me.
And we will do this again, if not in August. We'll do it in August, but there may be something intervening between
now. Okay. Sounds good. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for everybody for coming and spending part of your Saturday afternoon with us.
Okay. And Sunday morning.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think the larger audience is probably the national audience.
Right. Well, thank you for spending some of your Sunday morning with us as well.
Okay. Indeed. So you get we get to rule the whole weekend.
Yes. Yes.
So take good care.
You too.
Randy, thanks a lot. And say hi to Maury for me.
I will do. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Bye, everybody.
I'm Dan Persons, and this is my Hour of the Wolf review. The new Brazilian film, King Car, which is available now on demand, is pretty out there. It's a lot of things at once: political satire, environmental treatise, surreal fantasy, and my time is limited, so I'm only going to scratch the surface here. In the film, a young man, Uno, played by Luciano Pedro Jr., has the ability to talk to cars, particularly an old, broken-down cab at his uncle's junkyard. With the help of his uncle, played by Matthias Nachtigall, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, sorry, Uno transforms the cab into a lavish, futuristic vehicle complete with its own voice box. Divino Teixeira does the ever-so-seductive voice, who immediately declares himself King Car, and who immediately has sex with a woman, because Brazil. And King Car's advent occurs at the same time a local politician of the town of Caruaru, where the film is set, is enacting what he's calling a zero-kilometer law, which requires any vehicle older than 15 years to be impounded. Which is a great step for the environment if you happen to have the cash to afford a late-model car. For everybody else who may have to rely on an older car to scrape out a living, they're just bleep out of luck. Something that King Car and his growing army of converted cars that are now facing obsolescence, built by a zombified core of teens, are not going to sit still for. So here we have a group of individuals, mechanical but sentient in this universe, who find themselves made obsolete by environmental crisis and the laws addressing the issue that shunt them to the side. And they just so happen to turn to an aged but charismatic leader whose populist message shades gradually into full-on fascism. Sounds eerily close to recent American politics, but I can't say for sure that King Car director and co-writer Renata Pinheiro had that in mind. It's just as likely she's talking about things closer to home, maybe even to the real town of Caruaru. Maybe that's even a pun, I don't know. What I can say is that in fine Brazilian film tradition, King Car exhibits an intense, passionate surrealness that transcends simple narrative. There's lots of stuff going on in the film, from Uno's birth being envisioned as a kind of automotive nativity to a pole dancer slash conceptual artist whose side gig is branding statues of dictators with the Hebrew word for dead using an illuminated metal G-string, to King Car founding an automotive dealership called King's Cars, which may or may not be a reference to Huey Long. Again, I'm not sure. What I am sure of is that I dug the wildness of King Car. Director Pinheiro does bring a distinctive vision to political satire, and if this is the kind of cool, hot stuff we're getting at the beginning of the year, 2022 may not be so bad after all. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Do it. You're listening to WBAI New York. It's now about 7:59. Coming up, wait for it, Morning Ursae. Countertenor Hatherley Clark starts us off today. That was Chime Again, Beautiful Bells, composed by John Bishop. Recorded way, way back in 1916 on the Zonophone label. This from one of the great CDs. It's on the shelf of the 20 greatest CDs in my collection, and that is a Pearl CD that was released somewhere in the 80s called The Historic Countertenor. And some of these are just, some of these voices, you're probably familiar with all of them because it's one of my go-to CDs because it never fails. It never lets down. I'll play you from this CD one of the most astonishing songs that's on this CD. You'll love it. You've probably heard it already. You've probably heard it already like 10 times because I just can't stay away from it. And before that, of course, we had our theme song, Natalia Janota, playing the Mendelssohn Spinning Song. Nice day today for polar bears. It's a little on the cold side, but nothing we can't handle. I did prepare for it, though. Did I say it's James Ursay here? I don't want you to know. I don't want you to think it's a stranger filling in, a doppelganger. Or a vocal doppelganger. You want me to do my imitation of an imitation in James Ursay voice? I can do that. This is James Ursay now. Talking to you on Sunday in the morning. It sounds pretty good, right? It's close. Close enough. So I thought, well, the cold weather is coming. So I'm going to get me some long underwear. That's great stuff, isn't it? Right? You know what I'm talking about? Really good. Long underwear is very, very helpful. Very helpful. So I went into the store where people who don't have a lot of money go. It's where things are packaged. They look so neat and nice, and everything is folded up on the hangers and little plastic containers. I thought, all right, this is just what I need. And I went into the store. It's on Fifth Avenue and Ninth Street in the great borough of Brooklyn. And there was a whole rack of long underwear. It came with shirt and pants. I thought, yeah, baby, this is what I'm looking for. And I picked up a pair. It looked white in the package. The package had it looking white, and that's what I wanted. You know what I mean. That old white, comfortable, warm long underwear. So I picked up the package. I went home. This morning I opened it for the first time because this morning, you know, it's a little bit of a chill in the air. And first of all, this is how people cheat you. We should have a show, an hour show, on how people cheat you. We could all have call-ins and everything. Well, I was cheated just yesterday. Somebody came up to me. So I open up the package, and what did I see first? It was dark blue, not white. How did they do that? They just painted over on the plastic a color that made it look white. When you open it up, you see it's blue. Not what I wanted. Then there's the question of the size. Now, this is made in a country where people are generally smaller. It's like if you go traveling in a country where people are generally not big, fat Americans, big, fat, overfed, disgusting Americans. You go on a bus, you know, and the bus seats are much smaller in these countries. I can attest that the Dominican Republic and India are two countries where the bus seats are not very large. So I thought, well, I could get medium, but, you know, I'll tell you something. Medium is something in the past for me. I still sometimes try to fool myself into thinking, well, you know, you're a medium because I feel medium. You know, it's like when you get old. Get into your 80s. I'm not in my 80s yet, but I'm getting there. And you still feel young inside, don't you? I still feel like the idiot, the talkative idiot, say the wrong thing at the wrong time jerk that I've always been. But I'm not. I shouldn't think like that. I should think more maturely now, although I don't. But in terms of size, I've always been a medium. I was born a medium. But I've dropped medium long ago. And my wife. Take my wife, please. She likes to order things online. Macy's is her big target. Not in Target, you know, Macy's, the store. She buys shirts for me. It's a lovely thought, but she still hasn't learned two things about buying shirts for me. The two most important things about buying shirts for your man. First, they've got to have pockets. Who wears a shirt without a pocket? Where are you going to put that pen? Where are you going to put the keys? Where are you going to put the Metro card? You need pockets in a shirt. What use is a shirt without a pocket? Well, if it's a T-shirt, of course, you don't expect a pocket in a T-shirt, but then you wear another shirt over it where you can put something in the pockets. Shirts need pockets. And the other thing about the shirts, she still buys me medium. I hate that. I'm just not a medium anymore. I'm a large. But staying on subject, I went to get this long underwear set at the cheap crap store on when will I learn? You know, if you want to get something that'll please you, you can't buy things in those stores. You buy pajamas or something that has that kind of, oh, that's so soft. It feels like flannel. You could rub it against your face. Within 3 weeks, the legs have turned into gigantic bell bottoms. They stretched out. Do you know what I mean? You start tripping over the legs in these things. They're so cheap. I've got to stop doing this. Well, anyway, I thought I'd better get a large. And I tried it on today for the first time, thinking I'm smart. I got the large. I didn't get a medium. I'm not tempted to go back in time and get the medium when I used to be a medium. I could barely squeeze into it. I don't know. It must have been made in Munchkinland or something. It was tiny. It is. I'm wearing it now. I can't even breathe. It's so tight. And it doesn't. I can't hold it onto my waist because it's not big enough to reach my waist. So it's drooping down. I know you know how that feels, right? Don't even make me describe it. It's just. It's working itself down. You know where that's going, right? It's, believe me, it's a-